Jake S8, I suppose. I'm doing a master's project on urban runoff control using rain gardens at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and that is what we'll be talking about today. This project was funded by the Terry and Kathleen Kurt Distinguished Graduate Fellowship. So what are rain gardens? Rain gardens were a concept that were developed in the Chesapeake Bay Area of Maryland, in Prince George County specifically, as a means to control water that's running from impervious surfaces. So basically, they're a flat bottom depression in the native landscape that collect the water draining off the impervious surfaces. Novotny and Olem found that impervious surfaces comprise between 20 and 85% of our landscape, depending on development type. The majority of this is rooftops, asphalt, sidewalks, road tops, things of that nature. But Gibbons found that rooftops may compose up to 25% of our impervious surfaces in the urban areas. The design of rain gardens are variable, but the goal is the same. We want to decrease the runoff and increase groundwater recharge. Both of them are becoming very important issues around us today. So the current recommendations, as described by the Wisconsin DNR rain garden manual, give us instructions for placement, sizing, and construction guidelines. Placement, sizing, and construction guidelines are based on several parameters, including the area of the impervious surface that is draining to the rain garden, the slope of the natural existing vegetation, and also the soil type that is in the location. The planting scheme that they recommend basically involves native plants, prairie plants, wet prairie wildflowers, sedges, grasses, and rushes. And these are used because their deep rooting content is supposed to allow for more infiltration and decrease the amount of runoff that we see going from our impervious surfaces. However, we know that turf creates a very dense surface. This dense surface creates a tortuous pathway that might also decrease runoff and allow for more infiltration. So we wanted to compare the turf grass that your typical homeowner already has in place to the prairie plants that are recommended by the Wisconsin DNR. We hypothesized, based on the vegetational guidelines that I just talked about, that berms are the functional components of rain gardens, not the vegetation type. And this is in comparing the prairie plants to the turf grass. Our project objectives were to determine what factor or factors determine rain garden effectiveness. It could be the vegetation, in this case turf versus prairie type. It could be the berms, the sizing of the berms, or it could be an interaction between the vegetation and the berms. In this case, we're measuring effectiveness by runoff and leachate water quantity and quality. Our project design was a 2x2 factorial randomized complete block design with 4 replications. We had 4 treatments that were designed appropriately based on the guidelines that I talked about before, with our rooftop size and the area of Kentucky bluegrass that we had in between the rooftops and the treatment areas. These treatments were Kentucky bluegrass with and without 5-inch berms, and these berms were also sized based on the Wisconsin DNR rain garden manual. The sod was laid in October of 2005. It received 150 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per year. It was mulch mowed at approximately 7.5 centimeters once a week, depending on growing conditions. The prairie plants were established using vegetative plugs, basically mini plants of the prairie plants that we see out there now. These were maintained basically without any maintenance besides clearing the vegetation in the spring of 2007. The prairie plants and the Kentucky bluegrass were both watered in the early establishment phases, but after that they received no supplemental irrigation. Our water collection was done for runoff using a series of modified PVC weirs that was on the downslope of the plots. These weirs collected water and funneled it into our large collection devices, which I pumped to collect leachate volume, or runoff volume, and also to get the runoff samples. Our leachate water was collected using low-tension lysimeters. These lysimeters were placed in a side cave to minimize the disturbance of the water that was coming down through the soil profile. The data that I'll be talking about today is highlighted in yellow. I'll be going over runoff volume, total suspended solids, and total phosphorus concerning runoff. In 2006, I had 41 runoff events. Runoff events were calculated as any time that runoff occurred, I collected water. Leachate volume will also be discussed, as will nitrate nitrogen in this leachate water. And this was collected as needed, and in 2006, I collected 11 times throughout the year. These other data are supplementary and I won't be talking about them. I'll begin by talking about our 2006 runoff data and then move on to the 2006 leachate data. Our graph here illustrates runoff on the y-axis and month of collection on the x-axis. Basically, this plot shows that regardless of vegetation type, berms controlled runoff. If there was a berm on the plot, it controlled runoff the same. The only real runoff that we got was due to the design of the weirs in relation to the slope of the berms. You can also see that the prairie without the berm, which is the bright pink bar in this case, had substantially more runoff volume, especially in the early portion of 2006. As it went throughout the year and we got more annual weed cover, and as the prairie plants established, it normalized with the rest of the plots. Our annual runoff volume, which again has runoff on the x-axis, or in the y-axis, and we delineated between annual total, frozen soil, and non-frozen soil using the temperature probes that we had on site. And this illustrates that most of our runoff fraction came from non-frozen soil. And again, the prairie without the berm, which is illustrated with the pink bar again, had significantly more runoff volume than did any of the other treatments in 2006. And this includes the turf grass without the berm. Total suspended solids loading was looked at because it's a requirement that's looked at with the U.S. Clean Water Act. We have total suspended loading on the y-axis, and again, we have it divided up into annual total frozen soil and non-frozen soil on the x-axis. You can see a substantial difference between the prairie without a berm and any of the other plots in terms of total suspended solids loading, and this is not a huge surprise. When we put in the plants, we put in approximately 67 plants per treatment, however, this did not equate to a whole lot of ground cover. And without this ground cover, there was a lot more availability for soil to run off, and without the berms, the soil ran off. Total phosphorus loading was looked at in runoff because phosphorus has been linked as a limiting nutrient as far as surface water eutrophication goes. We have phosphorus loading on the y-axis and month of collection on the x-axis. This plot relates to the two previous that I talked about in terms of runoff volume and total suspended loading because we know that phosphorus oftentimes absorbs to soil fractions, and this can come out in the total phosphorus loading. So the unbermed treatments had substantially higher total phosphorus loading than in the berm treatments due to the combination of higher sediments going into it and also a higher volume. And several times throughout the year, not only in the unfrozen situation, we saw a statistically significant difference in this. I'll be moving on to our leachate data right now. The leachate volume for 2006 and 2007 is expressed in volume on the y-axis. Once again, we saw our bermed plots, regardless of vegetation, had significantly more leachate going through our soil profile than did the unbermed plots. And we looked at nitrate-nitrogen concentration because this is a standard that is regulated by the US EPA in terms of 10 parts per million or milligrams per liter being the maximum acceptable concentration for safe drinking water. This plot shows no statistical significance between any of the treatments, and all the treatments were well below the 10 parts per million standard that has been developed by the US EPA. Nitrate-nitrogen concentration was also examined. We had nitrate concentration in milligrams per liter on the y-axis and date of collection on the x-axis. You see a trend that is very similar to any trend that you see with a disturbed site, in that the nitrate-nitrogen concentration was very high initially, and over time it leveled off. Another thing to note in this graph is that the unbermed treatments had statistically significant higher nitrate-nitrogen concentration on several dates, and this can be pinpointed to the fact that denitrification is promoted by higher soil moisture content, and with the berms trapping more water, we had higher soil moisture content in these berm plots. So we concluded that the presence of berms is the most important factor in determining rain garden effectiveness off of rooftops. Regardless of vegetation type, both berms performed exceptionally well in reducing the amount of volume of runoff that was coming off the plots and in promoting infiltration and percolation of water into our soils. There are several vegetation considerations to look at. First, we have establishment issues. Prairies take substantially longer to establish than did the turf grass sod, which was essentially instantaneous establishment. And this could shift over time as the prairie plants become more developed. As the prairie plants become more developed, they might allow for less infiltration and more high quality percolation, but that will, time will tell, I guess. For a person looking to put in a rain garden, I think that preference, cost, and functionality are the basic considerations that you have to look at. Our rain garden plants in this study cost approximately 7 times more than did the sodded turf grass, and if you add that up over an entire rooftop, that can be pretty expensive. I think it's imperative that we look at soil type effects in future research. We were able to establish this plot on a former putting green that has pretty good soil properties with low compaction. And I think that's essential that we look at a more typical urban soil that's highly compacted in future research to see if this trend holds up. With that, I thank you and I'll take questions.